Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. This is Episode 9, Ancient Solar Energy, Part 5. Subtitle, The Wonder Twins Meet the Elephant in the Room. Stick with me on that one. It will make sense, I promise. Over the last few episodes, we've been drilling down deep on natural gas, focusing on where it comes from, its twisty-turny history as a fuel, and the major challenges and opportunities of its production. With a big shout-out to cartoon superheroes, the Wonder Twins, in the form of hydraulic fracturing, aka fracking, and horizontal drilling. We ended the last episode more than a little freaked out by the water and seismic risks of fracking, and, taking a deep breath, ready to jump into the third big risk associated with natural gas production, methane leaks. As you recall, what we've branded natural gas is primarily the chemical methane, and although the other components of natural gas leak out when gas leaks, I'm going to focus on methane for reasons that will be clear as we go. So let's set the stage. Remember that bamboo-piped gas operation in China in 211 BC, which, despite everyone's best efforts at the time, I'm sure, undoubtedly leaked methane all over the place. Now we have big metal pipes, sturdy couplings, sophisticated valves, and ultra-sensitive monitoring technology that our ancestors couldn't even imagine. Big, robust, highly engineered systems, heavy metal in the most literal sense. But we're still talking about and actively worrying methane leaks from our natural gas systems today. Remember, at this point in the story, we still haven't burned the stuff yet. We're just getting it out of the ground. So fast forward from Qin Dynasty China, eyes wide, wide, wide open. It's been almost 2,500 years. How much progress have we actually made? Spoiler alert, a lot less than you might hope, and with a climate impact that is a lot bigger than you might imagine. And that climate impact throws significant uncertainty on a big, widespread, and impactful assumption that natural gas has a smaller climate impact than coal. Does natural gas, in fact, have a smaller climate impact than coal? Well, let's start with why. Why all the fuss about methane? It's not carbon, after all. Just to recap, there are a number of gases in the greenhouse gas category, with carbon dioxide, often abbreviated to CO2 or just carbon, being the big climate impact and grabbing most of the headlines. We don't talk about it as much, but methane is right there too, driving climate change in a different and powerful way. In very simple terms, if CO2 is a furnace, methane is a blowtorch. Now, compared to CO2, methane is much shorter lived as a greenhouse gas, which sounds like a good thing, right? But it is many, many, many times more powerful a greenhouse gas while it's still in the atmosphere. Like 80 times, 80 times more heat trapped in our atmosphere than by methane over a 20-year period. While CO2 traps a lot less heat, but over centuries. So methane emitted in our lifetimes is a powerful driver of climate change during our lifetimes. That's the blowtorch. While the carbon dioxide, say, emitted by old King George's fireplace as he cursed we rebellious colonists here in the New World, is still driving climate change too, albeit more insidiously and less dramatically. The blowtorch, and the furnace. More tragically, though, methane leaks are lose-lose, economically and environmentally. CO2, at least, results from economy-positive fossil fuel power generation and the like. So when you combine that with its blowtorch climate impact, reducing methane in the atmosphere should be a priority, if not a no-brainer, no matter what your worldview or decision-making process. But so far, it's not. And methane leakage is responsible for a full 5% of global GHG emissions. 5% may not seem like a lot on the surface, but remember, the denominator in that equation is essentially the entire planet. And we're talking about medium-term climate impact, 80 times that of CO2. So that 5% represents a tremendous amount of climate change. And with nothing positive, like electricity production, for example, to show for it, lose-lose. For those reasons, reducing methane emissions from oil and gas operations is one of the most effective, impactful actions we can take to mitigate climate change, to meet our ambitious and necessary climate goals. We don't have to look very hard for those leaks. They start right at the wellhead. And for brevity's sake, that's where I'll focus the analysis. Not every wellhead, of course, although studies have shown average leakage rates between 3 and 10% for operating wells. Keep those numbers in the back of your head, 3 to 10% for operating wells. Those are big numbers for an ostensibly modern system, but the averages, like all averages, hide a lot of nuance too, a lot of necessary complexity. Here's a big one. Leak information is more about extrapolated assumptions than actual measurement. Two key words there, assumptions and extrapolation, not measurement. In other words, estimate the number of wells and multiply that by a generalized assumption about leakage per well. And that generalized assumption, it turns out, is remarkably optimistic, to say the least. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, for example, specifies a near zero leakage rate, 0.2%, to be exact, far smaller than the 3 to 10% that is actually occurring. So it's really skittles and unicorns and rainbows from start to finish, with the actual environmental impact completely unknown and no real mechanism to fix and identify and fix leaks. Even with the new monitoring technologies available, operators effectively have no obligation to physically monitor their infrastructure, and regulators, understaffed and underfunded, rarely collect data on their own. Simply put, the companies that extract, process, and transport gas, and oil for that matter, have no obligation to know the pollution profile of their activities. And with only assumptions and extrapolation, regulators are like a handful of police officers trying to patrol the entire country's highway system with radar guns set to read 55 miles an hour, regardless of the speed of actual traffic. Studies have shown that leakage rates also vary widely by location. There are both super leakers and super diligent operators out there, both in the U.S. and around the world. Economics are a motivator, as natural gas-focused production tends to leak less than oil-focused production. And that makes sense. Gas production is there to produce and sell gas, and thus producers have an economic incentive to minimize leakage of the very stuff they want to sell, at least when they're operating the well. Leaked gas, of course, cannot be sold. But if you're after oil, gas is at best a byproduct. The economic incentives to minimize methane leaks just are not there. And all that gets averaged out over the spectrum of operators and hundreds of thousands and millions of wells nationally and globally. That makes it very, very difficult to regulate effectively, which, in the absence of strong economic incentives, is really the only way to drive change. But wait, it gets worse. That 3 to 10% is just the operating wells. There are an estimated 800,000 abandoned wells across the U.S. and untold millions around the world. Take that 3 to 10% average leak rate for operating wells and then double it for abandoned wells, at least. As the great Neil Young once said, rust never sleeps. Pipes, valves, joints, pumps, you name it. State laws usually require that operators plug wells with cement at the end of their service life. Effective, but costly and complex. So the devil gets right into the details. If an operator can maintain the fiction that a well is still in service, even if it's barely producing, it can just sit and leak. And leak. As a well's production declines, it tends to get sold by a big, well-capitalized operator to a more opportunistic and less well-capitalized operator. They have no obligation to reserve for plugging costs when the well is drilled. Combine that with weak regulatory oversight, and those wells often don't get plugged at all, with the environmental consequences we've just been talking about. Theoretically, the plugging obligation then falls to the state, aka government staff to do it and taxpayers to pay for it. But even then, regulators are worried that pushing marginal operators too hard on compliance will create financial stress and thus reduce plugging even further, not to mention impacting the jobs and taxes that these old wells might still support. So in the real world, that means that a large percentage of abandoned wells remain uncapped for a long, long time, maybe forever, releasing huge amounts of climate blowtorch methane into the atmosphere. One more important but depressing reality while we're at it. Even if the operator is both capitalized and motivated to do the right thing, the opportunity cost of capital is a zero-sum game. For those who don't speak the language of economics, that means that even if leaks can be fixed by the operator at no net cost, the operator likely has much higher return opportunities for that finite capital than simple cost offsets. Why spend that money on plugging wells when you can spend it making more money? So absent an effective regulatory regime to drive the operator to make that lower return investment, those leaks don't get plugged. In the meantime, remember that natural gas is odorless, tasteless, and colorless. So until it gets odorized, far downstream of the well in the pipeline, no one would even know to complain. As I said, that's just at the wellhead, but illustrative of the larger systemic problem. Methane is leaking in vast climate-changing quantities. How does that play into the math of climate change mitigation? Simply put, a 70% drop, 70% in these oil and gas methane emissions is needed in the medium term. That's hundreds of thousands of wells that need to be fixed in the U.S. alone, millions worldwide. Which leads us to the potentially assumption-busting question that I posed at the beginning of the episode. Is natural gas, in fact, more climate-friendly than coal? The whole world hopes that this is the case. The U.S. Department of Energy estimates that coal-to-gas switching is responsible for approximately two-thirds of the emissions reductions from power generation between 2005 and 2018. Two-thirds. That's a big white hat, but that's measured at the point the gas is burned at the power plant. And the data and calculations at the burn are really good. But as we've seen, the data upstream of the burn, back at the wellhead, for example, are based on profoundly incomplete and imperfect data, and thus calculations. In other words, Skittles, unicorns, rainbows, not actionable, accurate information. But even if we take the data we have as true, we've still got a black hat on our hands relative to coal. Peer-reviewed studies differ, but gas loses its GHG advantage over coal between 3% and 9% leakage. And those recent leakage studies, again, subject to the crappy data, are seeing about 9% leakage system-wide. Uh-oh. Now, I don't think the data is good enough to draw definitive conclusions, but it begs the massive assumption-busting question, is natural gas actually more climate-friendly than coal? On balance, I think it's too close to call, and not the slam-dunk yes that many of us assume. The fact that it's even close is in itself deeply disturbing. Our energy transition is based in large part on natural gas as a bridge fuel to a zero GHG, or close to zero GHG power system. And that power system, in turn, is the basis for the climate-saving electrification already underway. So we have to make it so, not just imagine it so. That means finding and fixing those leaks. The International Energy Agency says that the 70% leak reduction we need actually lines up with the amount of leakage abatement that is technically feasible. Although economic feasibility, as opposed to technical feasibility, depends a lot on the price of natural gas, how much lost revenue those leaks might represent, and how effective our regulations are in making the operators do the right thing. And remember, this is all before we actually burn the stuff, just to be absolutely clear. So what now? I see three main barriers to overcome, all wrapped in opportunity for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy. Those three barriers are information, infrastructure, and incentives. Needless to say, information is first and foremost. Information is visibility, and visibility is the fundamental prerequisite to action. As we've seen, though, information, the what, where, how, when, and why of all that leakage, is still, in fact, the elephant in the room. Or, more accurately, the one in the old Buddhist parable of the blind men encountering an elephant for the first time. The parable goes back at least as far as 500 BC, during the lifetime of the Buddha, in fact. But here in 2023, I'm going straight to Wikipedia, and I'll modernize and summarize from there. As the story goes, a group of visually impaired people encounter a strange animal called an elephant, but none of them is aware of its shape or form. They were curious, of course. They couldn't use their sense of sight while being visually impaired, but they could use their sense of touch. The first person whose hand landed on the trunk said, "It's a thick snake." To another, touching the elephant's ear declared the beast to be like a fan. And so on. The elephant's leg, a tree trunk, its side, a wall, its tail, a rope, and its tusk, a spear. Each person, sensing only the one aspect that they encountered, had a wildly incomplete and inaccurate understanding of the entire thing. Now, in some versions of the parable, the men come to blows over their disagreements about the elephant. In others, they collaborate to create a mutual understanding of the whole animal. As you've probably surmised, we are a lot closer to the former than the latter when it comes to methane leaks. So information is a huge action item. Effective incentives, in turn, can improve both involuntary and voluntary actions. Involuntary actions like regulatory schemes and enforcement, voluntary actions like abatement and other compliance and innovation by operators, including, and I'll explain this in a second, consumer-facing product differentiation. Which leads us to opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy. First and foremost, we need leak detection that is continuous, granular, cost-effective, and actionable. Full disclosure here, I find the leak detection problem so profound and impactful that I have some sweat equity in a startup called Earthview, which is pioneering a really cool technology for just that sort of well pad monitoring. Once those leaks are found, we need abatement technologies and techniques that are simple and cost-effective. More broadly, I see a need to decommoditize natural gas. In other words, creating certification regimes for responsibly produced natural gas so that customers can vote with their wallets for better environmental outcomes. Think of dolphin-safe tuna in the world of food. I, for one, would pay more for methane-safe natural gas if given the opportunity. These opportunities assume, as I do, that natural gas will be around for a while. Perhaps not in the quantities that we use now, but still plenty to make a difference. Beyond natural gas, we need to find alternative uses for existing natural gas infrastructure, all those pipes and power plants. Green hydrogen, which we'll explore soon, is a candidate for this repurposing. And of course, electrification, replacing natural gas with electricity in uses like space heating and cooking, benefiting both climate and public health. Aside from these opportunities for innovation and entrepreneurship, the opportunities for advocacy are also legion. Regulations generally, both text and teeth, so to speak, must be made effective across the natural gas value chain, from data gathering and disclosure standards to incentive creations, especially, I think, pre-funding end-of-life liabilities. The closer we look, the more the white hats and the black hats start to blur together. The more questions than answers, opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy. Often, or at least sometimes, probably maybe sort of better than coal, but not great. Maybe doing it better, but certainly not doing it well. And unfortunately, not that far along from 211 BC in China, after all, 2.5 millennia ago. Multiply all that by the massive increase in volumes coming out of the earth and into the climate thanks to fracking and horizontal drilling, and we start to see the magnitude of the compromise we've made and are making across prosperity and climate change, economic opportunity, and environmental justice. While I believe firmly in prosperity, I also believe in externalities, many of which are not yet captured in the attractively low natural gas prices we've enjoyed as our economies have grown. Here's the kicker. I am convinced we can live in a coal-free world. Can we live in a natural gas-free world too? I'm not so sure. I am sure that a lot of gas-based infrastructure, like the power generation we'll explore next time, can be fueled with other things. I'm also sure that a lot of things we now use natural gas for can be accomplished with electricity instead. A lot to explore, a lot to ponder, and a lot to act on. I'll see you in about 2 weeks for another episode of Climate Changes Everything. Thanks for listening.